This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and it's a big day for financial news out of Washington. We're waiting for President Donald Trump to announce his nominee to head the Federal Reserve. He's expected to name Jay Powell, who's been serving as Fed governor since 2012. And we will go to that announcement live as soon as the president begins speaking. Meanwhile, House Republicans today unveiled their tax overhaul plan. It's a sweeping $1.51 trillion plan to cut taxes for corporations, reduce them for some middle-class families, and make deep changes to some very popular deductions. Now, if the plan passes, it would be the biggest tax overhaul since 1986, but that's still a big if, since just about everyone expects a major legislative battle over the GOP's proposals. And it looks like now the president has actually arrived, and he will be speaking about his new nominee for Fed chair. So let's go to that.
This afternoon. Also, I want to welcome the chairman of the Senate Banking Committee, who's done an incredible job, Mike Crapo. Where's Mike? Please, Mike. Great job. Appreciate it. As president, there are a few decisions more important than nominating leaders of integrity and good judgment to hold trusted positions in public office. And few of those trusted positions are more important than the chairman of the Federal Reserve. Accordingly, it is my pleasure and my honor to announce my nomination of Jerome Powell to be the next chairman of the Federal Reserve. Congratulations, Jay.
Thank you, Mr. President. Thank you.
Jay is joined here by his wife, Lissa, and his two sisters, Monica and Elizabeth. And I say congratulations to you all. Please, take that bow. Please, you deserve it. Thank you very much for being here. Today is another important milestone on the path to restoring economic opportunity for the American people. In just a short time, we have already made incredible strides. Unemployment is at its lowest level in more than 16 years. You know that very well. You know that very well, and you're happy about it. We've now had back-to-back quarters of 3% growth, a major accomplishment, and we're doing better and better every single week. But if we are to sustain all of this tremendous economic progress, our economy requires sound monetary policy and prudent oversight of our banking system. That is why we need strong, sound, and steady leadership at the United States Federal Reserve. I have nominated Jay to be our next federal chairman, and so important because he will provide exactly that type of leadership. He's strong, he's committed, he's smart. And if he is confirmed by the Senate, Jay will put his considerable talents and experience to work leading our nation's independent central bank, which has the critical responsibility to set monetary policy and monitor our banking system as a whole. There are few more important positions than this, believe me, in our government. Jay has served on the Federal Reserve Board of Governors since 2012. During his 5 years at the Fed, Jay has earned the respect and admiration of his colleagues for his hard work, expertise, and judgment. He has proven to be a consensus builder for the sound monetary and financial policy that he so strongly believes in. Based on his record, I am confident that Jay has the wisdom and leadership to guide our economy through any challenges that our great economy may face. Jay has earned the respect of members of Congress straight across party lines. For each of his appointments to the Fed, the Senate confirmed Jay with strong support from members of both parties. That's unusual. I hope the Senate will swiftly confirm him once again. Jay will also bring to the Fed a unique background of prior government service and business experience. He previously served as Undersecretary at the Department of Treasury in the administration of President George H.W. Bush. And just like William McChesney Martin, the longest-serving chairman in Federal Reserve history, Jay will bring extensive private sector experience and real-world perspective to our government. As a result, he understands what it takes for our economy to grow. And just as importantly, he understands what truly drives American success, the innovation, hard work, and dreams of the American people. I also want to thank the current chair, Fed Chair Janet Yellen, a wonderful woman who's done a terrific job. We have been working together for 10 months, and she is absolutely a spectacular person. Janet, thank you very much. We appreciate it. For the past 4 years, she has served with dedication and devotion, and we are grateful for her total commitment to public service. The Federal Reserve is one of the most important institutions in our government. It is respected all around the world and is crucial to our economic prosperity. I am confident that with Jay as a wise steward of the Federal Reserve, it will have the leadership it needs in the years to come. Thank you, and God bless you all. Now I would like to invite Jay to say a few words. Thank you. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Mr. President, for the faith that you have shown in me through this nomination. And I'm both honored and humbled by this opportunity to serve our great country. If I am confirmed by the Senate, I will do everything within my power to achieve our congressionally assigned goals of stable prices and maximum employment. I want to thank my wife, Alyssa, for her love, support, and wise counsel. Without her, quite honestly, I would not be standing here. We're thinking today of our three children and of the world they're inheriting. My five siblings and I, two of whom are here today with me, are also thinking today of our parents, who gave us so many gifts, including, most of all, a loving home. In the years since the global financial crisis ended, our economy has made substantial progress toward full recovery. By many measures, we're close to full employment, and inflation has gradually moved up toward our target. Our financial system is also, without doubt, far stronger and more resilient than it was before the crisis. Our banks have much higher capital and liquidity. They're more aware of the risks that they run, and they're better at managing those risks. While post-crisis improvements in regulation and supervision have helped to achieve these gains, I will continue to work with my colleagues to ensure that the Federal Reserve remains vigilant and prepared to respond to changes in markets and evolving risks. Finally, to echo the President's remarks, I've had the great privilege of serving under Chairman Bernanke and Chair Yellen, who guided the economy with insight and courage through difficult times while moving monetary policy toward greater transparency and predictability. Each of them embodies the highest ideals of public service, unquestioned integrity, and unflinching commitment to fulfilling our mandate. Inside the Federal Reserve, we understand that monetary policy decisions matter for American families and communities. I strongly share that sense of mission, and I'm committed to making decisions with objectivity, based on the best available evidence, in the long-standing tradition of monetary policy independence. Mr. President, thank you again for this extraordinary opportunity to serve the American people. Thank you.
Thank you, Jay. Thank you, everybody. Thank you very much.
President, do you think you're in hot water in the Mueller investigation?
Is it too soon to discuss non-immigrant terrorism?
Well, you just heard President Donald Trump there announcing his nomination for the new head of the Federal Reserve. He announced that he's nominating Jay Powell. And the last couple of seconds there, you heard reporters trying to ask some questions of the president. But it looks like he's not taking questions this afternoon. So let's talk about the president's Fed chair nominee and also the other big financial news of the day, the GOP tax plan was released today. And joining us to talk about both of those things is Kathy Minahan. She is former president and CEO of the Federal Reserve Bank of Boston and also former dean of Simmons College School of Management. here as well. Kathy Minahan, it's great to have you back on the show.
Thanks, Magna. It's great to be here.
And also with us is Evan Horowitz. He's the Quick Study columnist for the Boston Globe. Evan, it's great to have you back as always.
Always a pleasure, Magna.
It was a good day, right?
Yeah.
Okay, so lots to talk about. So let's first of all focus on the president's announcement of his nomination of Jay Powell as his new... Or who may be the next Fed chair. I should note that it's the first time in, what, 40 years that a new president hasn't asked the current Fed chair to continue on for another term. And Janet Yellen's term does come to an end in February of next year. But Kathy Minahan, first of all, your reaction to Jay Powell as the nominee.
Well, first of all, let me start a little bit with Janet, because that characterizes or tempers my reaction to Jay. She's an incredibly skilled person and a recognized macroeconomist, thought of as one of the best in the world. She has an enormous amount of experience both on the Board of Governors as chair and previously vice chair, as chair of the Council of Economic Advisors. And, you know, I served on the Open Market Committee with her for 13 years. And she embodies a person who, at one level, at the very highest level of policy development, understands everything about macroeconomic policy, everything about Federal Reserve policy. But yet she's able to take that and translate it down mm-hmm. to the way that policy impacts the man on the street.
Right.
She's has incredible values, family-oriented, as I know people that had her as a professor when she taught at Harvard. They have nothing but fabulous things to say about her ability to convey difficult concepts, mathematical concepts in some cases where people find that hard sometimes, in a way that is both respectful of the person and absolutely on the mark.
Is this your way of saying that you believe she should have been serving another term?
Well, yeah, let me get to that. I mean, I think Jay is a very qualified person for many things. He's not a macroeconomist. He is a lawyer. He's had a lot of experience in the financial world. He was an undersecretary for domestic finance. He's been on the board for 5 years now. He's never differed from Chairman Yellen.
Mm-hmm.
He has followed her policies. He has never expressed anything other than satisfaction with the way the Fed, under her leadership, has proceeded to deal with the difficult issues of monetary policy in a very slow-growing economy, very difficult issues associated with where inflation is at a very low point,
right,
and where unemployment is also at a very low point, which is a conundrum that's really puzzling economists right now. So I say to myself, what's the trade here?
Why make the switch if he's not that different?
Yeah, right. Why make the switch? And there's a couple parts about this that I find really disturbing. First of all, that someone who's done such an incredibly great job at being chair of the Federal Reserve System, who's gotten so many accolades, could be removed from office sooner than any other chair has been in the last 40 years. And second of all, that switch is being made for clearly political reasons and replaces a very qualified woman with a man whose, at least his bio, is nowhere near as qualified.
So let me just jump in here if I can and turn to Evan here. I mean, I hear everything Kathy Minahan's saying. It seems like we'll have some continuity in terms of policy and decision-making between Janet Yellen and Jay Powell. But... you know, it is the president's prerogative to make a change when the current Fed chair's term ends. So maybe it's unusual, but it is the president's prerogative. So is this a big deal or not?
So, I mean, I think one of the reasons I'm very sympathetic to this argument. I think one of the reasons it's not getting a lot of traction is because people are sort of relieved that it's Powell and not some of the other names that were also on the list. Trump was considering a number of people who have very different views of the economy, who have been calling for years for tighter policy, for slowing the economy more quickly, hitting the brakes, and people were nervous. So I think once there was a recognition that, well, Powell is the front runner, people thought, okay, there is this problem, beautifully laid out, that well, we don't usually change Fed chairs after 5 years. Also, why are we replacing a woman with it? Like, what's happening? But at least he shares a view of the – he shares her view of the economy, is going to allow stimulus to continue on the moderate path. So I think that has blunted this critique in some ways.
Yes and no. You know, yeah, people are happy with it because policy has been good. And what she's been doing has been absolutely right. So you can be absolutely right and yet taken out of a position for which you are supremely qualified because of politics. And I would, you know, I would just put this out, gender. And it is truly disappointing. I think I could have understood it better if some of the other candidates had been chosen, because it would show that the president has a different view of policy, mm-hmm. and he does have a perspective. He does have a right to choose the policymaker that he thinks is going to carry through on measures that he believes in. So I could see him picking a Kevin Warsh, for example, right. if he was really interested in, you know, markets and tightening of policy and so forth. I could see him choosing other people if he's really interested in their theories of monetary policy. What I don't understand is choosing a man over a woman who's totally qualified, completely qualified, gained acceptance all over the world and kudos all over the world for politics and maybe for gender.
That suggests to me, in fact, you do understand. You don't. You just don't like that rationale, which is perfectly fine, right? Yeah. I don't disagree with you. I think I'm less concerned about understanding the rationale and more concerned about making sure we have someone leading the Fed who has the right view of what the economy needs. And that could have been Yellen. It can be Powell. I think that's okay.
But how does Jay Powell form that view? I would say that he forms that view because Janet Yellen has been such an incredible leader of an enormously competent staff down at the Fed. She and the staff have worked hard to deal with issues in the economy that really don't follow the usual rules these
mm-hmm,
days.
Mm-hmm. So right, that low inflation, low unemployment conundrum. Right.
He's benefited by her leadership. I must say I have a bit of concern, not a lot of concern because the staff is there, but she's been the leader. And he's benefited from that.
So let me just ask quickly here about sort of what we can learn from sort of some recent things that Jay Powell has said. Because I was just reminding myself that he was named earlier this year as the Fed's guy who would oversee the big banks, for example. And you know, he has on certain areas of banking regulation, he's called for, you know, sort of unwinding the Volcker rule, the so-called mm-hmm. Volcker rule, saying that he found that to be a tremendous expense and burden to banks, to the big banks, the too big to fail banks. So, I mean, what insight does that give us in terms of how he might actually be as chairman of the Fed?
Right. Well, certainly chairman would weigh in on those topics. But for the first time ever, the Fed now has a vice chair for regulation called Randy Quarles, who was an undersecretary for domestic finance in, I think, the second Bush administration. They've never had – this position's been open for a long time. They've never had anyone fill it. It's now been filled. So if you're looking to Jay Powell to be the regulatory czar, what happens to the other regulatory czar?
Mm. Mm-hmm.
I kind of wonder about that logic.
Yeah. Well, so can I ask both of you about sort of the immediate priorities or areas of focus that you think, if he is indeed confirmed by the Senate, that Jay Powell might have? And again, as just to acknowledge what you were saying a little earlier, Kathy, as a continuation of, it seems like, the policies and leadership that Janet Yellen had as Fed chair. I mean, for example, like the whole unemployment and inflation rate problem, which we've talked about a couple of times. I mean, what could the Fed do to sort of figure out that conundrum? It's I'm not sure what levers it can pull there.
Well, the Fed is also engaged in trying to unwind a $4 billion balance sheet.
Yeah.
And as they do that, $4 trillion.
Trillion, yeah,
I got
sorry.
The B's and the T's wrong,
for a second,
right?
I was saying.
an incredibly bad mistake on my part. No, a $4 trillion
right.
Balance sheet, which was the result of all of the quantitative easing that was put into place in the aftermath of the financial crisis, and a real focus on housing markets and loosening up lending and loosening up issues there. The Fed, by all that I've been able to read anyway, is still focused on the issues associated with their balance sheet.
Yeah.
Unwinding that has never been done before, so they're in uncharted territory. Other central banks have, you know, added to their balance sheets during this financial crisis. I believe we're the first ones who's really taking steps to unwind the size of the balance sheet. And you also have the issue associated with taking up the Fed funds rate in a very measured and slow way to try and balance off growth and the potential for inflation. And that's where the real problem is.
Yeah.
Where is inflation going, and where do interest rates have to be to create an environment, which the Fed likes to do, which is neither stimulative or restrictive for a particular level of economic growth?
Right, because from what I understand right now, that the lowish unemployment rate is signaling that the Fed could raise rates.
It's suggesting that resources are getting tight. Yeah,
yeah, but that the inflation rate is suggesting that maybe the Fed shouldn't increase rates, right? Like, there is that what's happening? We've got two different forces here pulling in different directions?
Or not. Or we're misreading one of them. I mean,
yeah.
Right. My take on it is, yes, everyone is saying that we're at close to full employment, but that's what they were saying in the Clinton years, and we pushed things down a lot further than people expected was possible. It may happen again. I mean, I don't sit on the Fed board, but I'm inclined to keep rates low until we actually see inflation, not worry about it. But I think the biggest problem that Jay Powell should attack is the what do we do when things go bad again problem if we don't have a lot of room for cutting rates.
That is a very good issue. And we'll be back in the situation of does quantitative easing work or doesn't it work? Initially, it seemed to work. Then after a while, the additions to the balance sheet didn't seem to be having much impact. The other issue I think that's out there that needs a lot of work is where has productivity gone?
Yeah.
You know, productivity is a key in this whole analysis. If people were really being productive, their wages would go up, and we would have the normal relationship between unemployment and inflation.
Yeah. I want to take a quick break here in just a second. But Kathy Minahan, before we do that, just your last thought on what kind of Fed chair Janet Yellen will be remembered as.
I think she'll be remembered as an incredible contributor to the communications and policy of the Fed, a great consensus builder, and someone who really felt monetary policy down to her fingertips and cared about everybody who experiences it.
Yeah. Well, Kathy Minahan is former president and CEO of the Federal Reserve Bank of Boston and also former dean of the Simmons School of Management. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you, Magna.
And Evan Horowitz, quick study columnist at the Boston Globe. Stick with us, okay, Evan? Because I want to talk taxes with you when we come back.
I ain't going nowhere.
All right, we'll be back. I'm Magna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. We're back. It's Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Let's talk about the other big dollars and cents news out of Washington today, and that is House Republicans unveiled their tax overhaul plan. It's the sweeping $1.51 trillion plan that cut taxes for corporations, reduces them for some middle-class families, and makes some significant changes to some very popular deductions. And, you know, there is still a question about whether or not the Republicans can get this over the finish line, because if they do, it would be the biggest tax overhaul since 1986. But folks are already lining up to fight, which is why at a press conference earlier today, the final question a reporter asked of House Speaker Paul Ryan was this.
If Republicans can't get this done, do you deserve to control the Congress?
What's your second question? We're going to get this done. You know why? Because the American people are counting on us. We're going to get this done because we told the American people this is what we're going to do if we get this majority. And guess what? We're doing it.
On the other hand, Democrats are already lining up their opposition. Here's Minority Leader Nancy Pelosi.
It is, again, deficit exploding, multi-trillion dollar giveaway to the wealthiest and corporations, delivered on the backs of our children, our seniors, and hardworking Americans. The priorities of the Ryan-McConnell bill have been clear from the start, perpetuating a catastrophic transfer of wealth from the middle class to corporations and the wealthy.
Well, that's the view from Democrats, but obviously House Republicans differ. Evan Horowitz from The Globe is here still with us. So, Evan, it's 423 pages. I've made it halfway through.
That's very impressive.
There are some highlights here. Let's talk about the collapsing of the tax brackets. We'd be down to basically roughly three tax brackets. This is a good simplification,
isn't it? They keep saying three, but it's three and a special tax bracket.
Yes.
My math says that's four, but they insist it's three. No, that's not what simplification means. I mean, that's not what makes taxes complicated. It's not how many brackets there are. It's where are the deductions and how much you have to pay someone to figure out what the deductions and how many lines of calculation. And that's not getting any simpler, at least not for people who itemize. That's still a big portion of people.
Right. So there's the dropping of the corporate tax rate. There's the reduction to down to 10% for repatriation of corporate funds held overseas. I mean, some people are looking at this and saying, we can talk about the individual side of things, but that this is a major change in the tax code because it basically tilts the tax code in the direction towards businesses that a lot of people have been calling for.
So that really is the heart of the bill, is the big corporate tax cut. And sure, lots of people, including lots of people who own corporations or own shares in corporations, have been calling for that. What's not clear is why everybody else should be embracing that. I mean, the economic argument...
Growth.
No, yeah. The economic argument for growth is relatively weak, especially if these things are financed by deficits, which is what seems to be happening. Also, just to get back to the Fed conversation, ultimately, the Fed decides how much growth we can have. And if they're not willing to let the economy grow faster than it already is at full employment, there's no way to get that much more growth out of the economy.
Okay. I take your point that the certain data shows things, but like this is a huge modification to the tax, to the U.S. tax code, the biggest we'd see since 1986. Is there not the opportunity to sort of further set an environment where this theory about reducing U.S. corporate tax rates may actually lead to greater growth? Is now not the time to at least try that out?
No, it's not that there wasn't an opportunity. It's not that it's not worth trying. It's that this plan doesn't really accomplish those things. I mean, there are ways to do this. You could have done a swap, for instance, where you lower the corporate rate, but maybe you increase the capital gains rate, so you have a kind of revenue neutral thing, but you think this is going to be better. Or you go, there was talk early on of switching to a VAT-like tax that is basically a big consumption tax. That also might have some big growth effects, but that's not where they went either. So it's not that there's a shortage of opportunities. It's that details really matter in the tax code. And the details of this plan are pretty haphazard.
Well, let's talk about some of the details in terms of the elimination or repeal or change in some of them are really popular deductions. And some of them hit here in Massachusetts particularly hard. For example, they want to cut the mortgage interest deduction in half. So you'd only be able to take a deduction off the interest of a loan of $500,000, a home loan of $500,000 or less. That's half of what it used to be.
Yeah. So let me just step back and say, for a year, we have been waiting to find out how they're going to pay for these things. Like, the Republicans have been talking about cutting the corporate tax since Trump was a candidate, and it was his tax plan. And then when Trump and Mnuchin introduced, you know, some things in March, and we've been waiting, well, this is great. How are you going to pay for these? And finally today, we have a detailed legislative plan to pay for them. And a lot of the plan involves eliminating deductions for upper middle class families, the one you mentioned, the mortgage interest deduction. Now, capping the mortgage interest deduction at $500,000 instead of $1 million doesn't matter to most people who have mortgages in America.
Right.
Virtually nobody in Texas has a mortgage
of $500,000.
Right. But it makes a big difference in greater Boston, where something like 10 to 15% of people with mortgages have mortgages over that amount. So, yeah, people are not going to be happy about it. And that's not the only deduction being eliminated that affects people. You know, think of them as like upper middle class people, people who earn between $100,000 and $200,000 a year. That's where a lot of the money is coming for to pay for the corporate tax cuts.
It's like the local state income tax deduction,
right,
which they want to eliminate.
That's the other one. So you usually, well, up to now, under current law, if you pay income tax to the state of Massachusetts, you can then deduct that from your federal tax bill. And this bill says, no, you can't do that anymore. You can still do property tax up to $10,000, but you can't do your income tax. So this is a big issue for states with substantial income taxes, not really Massachusetts, but New York, California. And it's a big deal for states like Massachusetts with lots of wealthy people who tend to itemize and take advantage of this loophole. So I think, yeah, Massachusetts is one of, there are plenty of places in the country where they're not going to care about a lot of these deductions. There's just not a lot of people who are going to be affected by them. But Massachusetts is one of these places where the deductions are going to hit pretty hard. And there are a couple of other blue states that are similarly positioned.
The student loan interest deduction, they want to repeal that. Deductions that some people can take for medical costs also on the chopping block. The alternative minimum tax. I'm just going through some of the list here.
The medical one is kind of a tragic one. I mean, so the medical the way this works is if you have huge medical costs amounting, out-of-pocket medical costs amounting to 10% of your income, then you can get a tax deduction. This is for people who have relatives in nursing homes. It's for people who have sort of a chronic or a really acute health problem. And people really rely on it to survive through a health emergency. And that's just going away under the bill.
Yeah.
And it doesn't actually raise that much money.
That's what I was wondering. I mean, you know, this is a $1.51 trillion plan. They had to keep it under the $1.5 trillion cap in order to avoid Democratic filibuster under reconciliation rules here. So, you know, how much do each of these little things get us to that $1.5 trillion?
Yeah, so most of these things aren't that big. What we've been talking about, billions or trillions, I forget. No, it's three. I mean, this is the problem when you're talking about big numbers. They add up. It's $300 billion over 10 years and another $250 billion over 10 years and another. But they needed these things because, they had to keep the deficit under $1.5 trillion over 10 years. So they rooted around for them. For instance, the estate tax is getting eliminated.
Well, after 6 years.
But not right away.
Right.
Why not right away? Well, because the math has to add up, and 6 years is the right amount of time to get the math to add up. You know, there's no principled reason not to eliminate the estate tax right away. That's precisely because they have to meet these requirements.
So they've stretched that out over 6 years, but you get they're doubling the exemption to $11 million in the first year for the estate tax.
But they can't eliminate it right away.
Exactly.
And so I will also say there are sort of two big hurdles for reconciliation. They hit the first one, but I don't think they've hit the second one. The first one is they have to stay within $1.5 trillion for 10 years, but then they have to have zero deficits after 10 years. And I haven't seen a full score of this bill, but I don't see how they manage that. I don't see anything that happens after the 10-year mark that changes the deficit creation of these tax cuts.
Yeah. There was an interesting thing sort of buried in the bill about 529s, the college savings plans that I noticed that the bill would allow for people to begin 529s for, in the language of the bill, unborn children, which is a new, very new thing. So I imagine in the coming days and weeks and months, and there is going to be a big fight over every aspect of this overhaul. The Republican leadership says they want to put a bill on President Trump's desk before Christmas. Do you think that's possible?
No, I don't think they can do it on that time frame. I mean, you now have institutional players, lobbyists, industries who are going to line up, specifically home builders. There's some small
business
groups.
They're already saying that they don't like the
mortgage interest
deduction.
And they're going to start fighting it. So I think Christmas is probably unlikely. But I do think, ultimately, Speaker Ryan is right. They will get something done because they have to. Not really because their voters demand it. I mean, the polling doesn't suggest that their voters really care that much about cutting corporate taxes. But donors really do care. And they have to do it for that reason. I will say, also say there's sort of irony to the fight, that as you're going to see a lot of progressives lining up to defend, you know, the mortgage interest deduction and state and local tax deduction. And you understand why, because, you know, the bill takes from upper middle class people to give to
very,
very
wealthy
people. But you can imagine a totally reversed universe in which it's conservatives who are defending these deductions as progressives want to eliminate the mortgage deduction for, say, I don't know, more generous rental vouchers, or they want to get rid of state and local tax deduction in order for to introduce a, I don't know, universal basic income or something. There's nothing about those deductions that is sacred to either side. It's what you do with the money once you eliminate them. And that's why things have sort of ended up on the sides that they're on.
And that's where the great battle is as well. Well, Evan Horowitz, the Quick Study columnist for the Boston Globe, giving us a first take on the big tax overhaul that House Republicans unveiled today. We'll have you back as the fight continues.
This isn't the last time they'll be talking taxes.
Evan, thanks so much.
Thank you, Meghna.
We'll be back. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.